Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Wednesday will mark the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, and on Wednesday we'll take a deep dive into what led to the establishment of that day and what has resulted from it. On this Politics Monday, however, we look at the politics of environmental activism. In 1970, polluted waterways and polluted air were generally acknowledged signs that we needed to do something about decades of environmental neglect. Cartoonist Walt Kelly's strip on that first Earth Day featured his beloved character Pogo saying, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." The growing activism that preceded Earth Day also played a role in the establishment of a federal agency tasked with making things better. On July 9, 1970, Richard Nixon, a Republican president, announced the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency to consolidate many disparate environmental responsibilities under one entity. Today, another Republican president is attempting to minimize the EPA and is actively rolling back environmental regulations that were put in place by the Obama administration. Over the years, and despite the fact that Republicans and Democrats share the planet, the environment has become just another flashpoint in our ever-growing political divide. Tim Profeta is the director of Duke University's Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions. That's a nonpartisan player in key environmental debates, and he joins us to shed some light on the politics of environmental policy. He joins us from somewhere in the nether regions of Wisconsin this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And Peter Dykstra is with us. For 17 years, he was CNN's executive producer for science, environment, weather, and technology. Prior to that, he was national media director for Greenpeace and can be heard weekly on Public Radio International's Living on Earth. He is also editor and columnist for Environmental Health News, which you can reach at ehn.org. Thank you for being here, too.
Hi. Thanks. Hello, Mike. Hello, Tim.
Welcome to you both. So I remember, I was thinking over the weekend about the very first Earth Day, because I remember it, and I remember taking part in it, and I remember at the time getting the impression that it was highly bipartisan. I couldn't find anybody who was not in favor of Earth Day or fixing the environmental things that were wrong with the Earth. Young and old, Republican, Democrat, they were all involved in this. Am I misremembering that, Tim? And if so, what changed?
I don't think you're misremembering at all. I think if you think about back in the 69 and 73 period when most of our environmental laws were passed with overwhelming majorities, there was a competition, political competition, to be the leader on the environment. President Nixon was the president who signed all those laws into being. He was really fighting with Senator Muskie from Maine, who he thought would be his competitor for the 72 election, and who was running the Senate committee who was designing those laws and trying to fight for credit for them. The environmental issues in that time were so much more tangible than they are right now. That might be the first answer to your question. You had the famous Cuyahoga River bursting into flames in Ohio. You had soot on the window sills of your apartment in New York City. It was somewhat undeniable that we had a big problem that needed solving. And when we have a big problem needing solving, usually American people demand solutions from both parties.
Yeah, you could chew the air in Los Angeles. And as you mentioned, rivers caught on fire. And I think just preceding the first Earth Day, there was a big oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara, California, that people were all up in arms about. I'm sure there have been worse oil spills since then, but that got people's attention. And as you point out, you could see this stuff. It's not like the coronavirus, which is invisible. You can only see the impact of it. Would you say that Richard Nixon was an environmentalist, or was he just on the same page with almost everybody else in America? This has to be fixed.
I would say that Richard Nixon was a very good politician, and he knew what America wanted.
50 years ago, Peter, all these concerns that we just talked about, rivers bursting into flame, litter was a concern on that first Earth Day. I remember people going out picking up trash in the medians, and I think that continues to this day because of those concerns. Air pollution, top of mind. Would we be concerned about climate change today had we done enough to deal with all of those things over the past 50 years?
Well, we've had our opportunities. There's actually some honest comparison we can make to coronavirus, where there's criticism that this country, maybe other countries, didn't act soon enough. I'll add in one of my favorite reference points for how the bipartisan nature of environmental politics has changed. This one is from the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, 1980. The League of Conservation Voters had started up. They measure, they do a scorecard of how members of Congress vote. And in 1980, there was a young congressman from Georgia that scored 50%. There was a young congressman from Tennessee that scored 35%. The congressman from Georgia who did better was Newt Gingrich. He did better than the congressman from Tennessee, Al Gore.
You also mentioned before we started this conversation on the air that you know, Richard Nixon gets all the credit for the Environmental Protection Agency, but you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. Of course, he created the National Park System. That's an environmental activity. And you went even further back than Teddy Roosevelt to William McKinley. What did he do?
Well, Teddy, of course, became president when William McKinley was assassinated, but in 1899, McKinley signed something called the Refuse Act. It was a part of the Rivers and Harbors Act. It was essentially the first water pollution law that the U.S. passed nationally. Horrible situations in water that continued. 1972, the Clean Water Act was passed. It was actually the only big environmental law that Nixon didn't approve of. He initially vetoed the Clean Water Act, but a bipartisan Congress overrode his veto. The Clean Water Act became law. Can you imagine today a bipartisan Congress doing anything like that?
Well, and Teddy Roosevelt, William McKinley, Richard Nixon, all three Republicans, but was that the same Republican Party that we have today?
No, not at all. And the Democrats have changed, too. If you go back to the League of Conservation Voter scores, Democrats averaged about 70%. Today, it's over 90%. So the polarization has gone in both directions. The Republicans were anywhere from 30 to 50% scoring on how well the environmentalists thought their environmental votes were. Now they're between 0 and 10%.
So Earth Day, the first Earth Day in 1970, was big news across the country. The New York Times had a great big picture on the front page of thousands of people in the streets. And the same thing happened across America in cities. People not protesting or demonstrating, but just rallying for the climate. But that was the first Earth Day. Things have changed a little bit over time. Tell me why, Peter, you say that Earth Day is a festival of good intentions, the metaphorically Earth-friendly pavement for a road to ecological hell.
Well, it's that's a cheerful note. It's good we're getting away from all the depressing coronavirus stuff and talking about the environment going down the tubes. Good intentions can somehow be harmful. And one example of how I think that's working today is there are a lot of ads about absolutely noble, positive, little efforts to clean up plastic. And in the meanwhile, we're seeing plastic dumped in our oceans, dumped in our freshwater. That's going to completely overwhelm ocean ecosystems if we keep it up. These little efforts are good, but they might have sort of an anesthetic value to tell people that the problem's being taken care of when clearly it's not. Same thing for climate change, same thing for a lot of issues. The big fixes are nowhere near. The little fixes are wonderful, but they're not going to get the job done.
So changing emission standards on automobiles, reducing and eliminating lead in gasoline, raising mileage standards for cars and trucks, that cannot have been politically easy to have been achieved, Tim, over the years, but we got it done. So why are the politics surrounding climate change apparently so much more difficult and complex today, when we clearly got things done that clearly made things better? Why now are we going, let's change that?
We'll take the whole show just on that one question. So let me just take a couple of swings at it. And I've spent the last two decades of my life trying to find the sort of policy solutions on climate change, and it is a difficult task, but I think I, in the end, end up an optimist, and I see trend lines in the right direction. Climate changes have sort of, let's just talk about three headwinds to trying to deal with climate change that really weren't as present in those other examples that you talked about. One headwind is our general politics in this country. As you've already referred to, we have a number of issues that are pushing us to the polls, whether it's gerrymandering or centralization of power in the parties or the media. Things are being pushed to the polls. So you end up picking your tribe, and issues tend to be grabbed by a tribe. So the Democrats are clearly the party of action on climate change. That's damaging because we operate in a 60-vote Senate, and it's very difficult to get anything done in terms of creating laws. Second, I'd say, climate change is a different sort of issue. And as a country, we've dealt very good with acute, tangible issues. We see them, we act on them, we demand our politicians act on them. When you're looking at a long-term systemic threat, like the risk of a pandemic, but also like climate, like our budget deficits, et cetera, our politics aren't wired to address those as well.
But when politicians have gotten together over the last 50 years and passed laws that have demonstrably made things better, how can it be politically expedient to get back together and repeal those laws or change the rules and regulations that will roll back the things that made things better? Now things will get worse. How can that be politically expedient?
I'm trying to grasp from your question where that example is on climate change.
Just in general, we have the president right now trying to roll back Obama administration guidelines,
right,
car standards and things like that. So if people wanted that, and they wanted it because they couldn't breathe and there was soot on the windowsills of your New York City apartment, why would they want to go back to that?
Well, I think the answer is, first of all, those were not passed laws. Those were executive branch actions. And I think that's politically, that's a place where the party in charge of the White House acts and the other party immediately demonizes those things, even if they're positive actions. I don't think that, there's a counter narrative on climate rules in particular, which is we're increasing the cost of energy in this country, et cetera. And there is a block of the electorate that is more cognizant of that concern than they are of the climate concern. And so it's our polarized politics, it's our party leaders appealing to their tribe, and that's their best path to re-election as they see it. This will not change until the American public demands action on this, can see with the foresight necessary the great risks of climate and other environmental issues, and demand that both parties take action on them.
When we come back, I want to talk about something else we have not mentioned that has changed since the first Earth Day in 1970, and that is our opinions of science and scientists, because we kind of believed them back in 1970, and today, not so much. We're going to come right back with Tim Profeta, director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions at Duke University, and Peter Dykstra of Public Radio International's Living on Earth. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Profeta is with us. He's the director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions at Duke University. Peter Dykstra is a former executive producer for science and environment at CNN and an environmental journalist now with the EHN.org, which is the Environmental Health News Organization. We're talking about Earth Day and the environment and how things have changed since the first Earth Day 50 years ago in terms of the politics of it all. Some question today the findings of science, and they now dismissed scientists and their findings, and they call scientists elitist. Fact-based data is being called into question everywhere about everything. 50 years ago, Democrats and Republicans worked together on the first Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. That same tension between the environment and the cost of cleaning things up and keeping things clean must have existed then, and we didn't question scientific findings or accuse scientists of being elites. Peter, why not?
It was a different attitude, and the kind of polarization we see on environment and on climate denial is evident this week in seeing protests at various state capitals demanding that that people start being unsafe with the coronavirus. It's kind of in the same league as climate denial. It tends to be many of the same people. But in terms of a change, one thing that can't be ignored is the Supreme Court Citizens United decision also 10 years ago that opened up the door for a lot more campaign contributions. That was a key in the Republican Party firmly planting its feet on the climate denial side. And I'll give you a brief roll call of some of the Republicans who embraced climate change as a scientific reality before Citizens United and switched afterward. Mitt Romney, who backed off when he ran for president in 2012. The late Senator John McCain is another one. Newt Gingrich, who sat for a famous TV commercial with Nancy Pelosi, where the two speakers of the House agreed that we had to do something about climate change. And my favorite one is Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin, for goodness sake, set up an Alaska climate sub-cabinet for all the issues that her state was going to face by the time she became a national figure. She was fully fledged in climate denial.
How is climate science or the environment, let's put it that way, because it's more than just the climate, it's cleanness, it's clean water, it's clean air, how is that at odds with conservatism? Why wouldn't that be right on the first page of their manifesto, their playbook, their belief system? It's keeping the earth the way it was intended.
Well, conservative and conservation are supposed to be supposed to be born out of the same root word. And that was an issue for not all, but so many conservatives back in the day. It's hard to say what happened other than maybe political opportunism or a lot of manipulation on the part of industries and extreme ideologues who wanted to see this issue polarized. A lot of the same people who are at the head of denying that the climate science was real are the same folks that came out of working against tobacco legislation or working against the ultimately successful legislation and an international treaty to begin to control the ozone layer.
Almost since the beginning of Rush Limbaugh's career on the radio as a national host and as a conservative mouthpiece, he has been railing against things like environmental policy that protects snail darters. That's one of his favorite examples. We're not going to build that bridge because we're going to hurt the life cycle of a snail darter. And it sounds ridiculous, even to the average person. It may not be. There may be real reasons to save the snail darter, ecologically speaking. But is there anything at all, Tim, to substantiate his claims and others that we have gone too far with our environmental protections?
In short, no, I don't think so. I think our environmental challenges have shifted to much bigger global threats that are harder to deal with politically, but there are even greater threats long-term to the health of human beings on the planet. I mean, in one of his books, Limbaugh once wrote that the Earth has been around for 4 billion years. It's going to be just fine. And I completely agree with him. The Earth will be fine. It'll be still here revolving around the sun. Whether human beings are happy occupants of the Earth has a lot better, more to do with how we take care of our house. And that's a challenge that's only intensified in the past, two decades. You know, we've done very good job on some of the first wave of environmental issues. We have another serious wave to deal with. Now, I want to say a couple things with some optimism. That conservation link to conservatism is still there. At the Institute, we just did a major poll and focus groups across rural America, red states, places that elected this president, and there's still a great belief in stewarding the land and the importance of water quality and things there. You ask them about climate change, it's become such a polarized issue, you get the predicted response. But if you talk to people about taking care of their environment, that ethic still exists, and I think we can try and come together as a country and work on those issues.
But Peter, go ahead.
But we have to meet people where they are. We have to meet where they're starting from, which is their belief in that they are stewarding the land themselves, and their honestly distrust of the federal government as an institution in a lot of these states as well, and really trying to work with them in their local communities and build that ethic back up.
Because you wrote, Peter, in an article about the 30th anniversary of Earth Day in 1990, you talked about, among other things, how the Congress in that year had environmental boosters in both political parties, but today no Republicans, zero Republicans, have demonstrated any pro-environmental moves. What are some of the other differences between today and 1990, just 30 years ago?
Well, one important distinction is that there are a few Republicans, as Tim says, that embrace environmental values. Still, they're all Republicans who are out of office, Republicans who are interested in not being challenged in the primary system, will either be very, very quiet about the environment, or they'll be very, very vocal against environmental regulation. That's a big change, but it's also a constant. One of the problems with environmental action is that often it takes a disaster to motivate the press, the politicians, and even the media to begin to pay attention. Mm-hmm. We're in a lot of slow motion disasters right now, 10 years out from the Deepwater Horizon spill. After that was the meltdown at Fukushima, Japan. And that same rebound that spawned the 1970 Earth Day, that spawned the 1990 Earth Day, as Tim said, hasn't really made itself plain yet. I'm just hoping that we can get it together before the next disaster hits. We'll see.
There are two arguments that you often hear from people who would like to roll back the clock and change regulations. One is that we have an abundance in this country of natural resources, which we're not going to run out of. And the other is that whatever happens that's wrong or bad that impacts people negatively, the marketplace will take care of that because people will demand it and the marketplace will respond. Do you think that is true, Tim?
In short, no. I mean, a couple of famous quotes. One thing is, in terms of natural resources, we do have an abundance of energy natural resources. But every time we pull up geologically stored carbon from underneath the ground where it's been stored away from and put it into our atmosphere, we are intensifying the climate effect and making it worse. The famous quote is, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. The Oil Age should not end because we ran out of oil. I think the marketplace I am firmly a believer in the capitalist system. I think the capitalist system has created more good for for mankind than any other system of the economy we've ever come up with, because people's drive to innovate and find a way to make money, to make capital, but also that brings benefits to people who want to market. The problem is the market doesn't see the environment. When you put pollution into the air, you are creating a cost for society that you don't pay for. And government's role is to put that back into the market so that when you put pollution in the air, you have to pay for it and you invest in something that's cleaner. And that's what most of our environmental policies do in one way or another. And that's government's role. And when government does that, fixes the market, then it can drive us to the solutions we need.
So in this current crisis, which doesn't have anything to do with the, although it may, the coronavirus crisis may have something to do with the environment. We don't know that yet. But during this current pandemic, we watched and witnessed a reluctance to listen to medical experts and scientists until the evidence about what they were talking about and what they were warning about became impossible to ignore. It was right there in your face. And the big concern now is how to balance the medical healthcare concerns against the economic concerns of all this, because people have to earn a living, and we're going to crush the economy for a very long time if we don't get back to work. Money seems to win out in the United States of America. Peter, will it win out this time?
One example where the marketplace is having an impact in terms of climate change is that the coal industry is having its lunch eaten in this country right now. The main factor has been the rise of fracking, where natural gas is cheaper to run electric power plants than coal is. Fracking obviously has its own problems and its own issues. But the other factor that's rising is that clean energy from wind and solar is becoming both more abundant and much, much cheaper. I know in eastern North Carolina, there's been a big rise in solar farm activity.
And we in North Carolina are situated in the best place, I think, on the East Coast for wind power, and yet we don't seem to be availing ourselves of that. I've been told that solar power actually creates more jobs than the coal industry. Is the problem with solar then that the jobs that the coal miners have are not geographically located where they'd have to be to have a job in the solar industry? Is that part of the problem, just dislocation?
Well, part of the problem is that politicians in coal-dependent economically places like West Virginia in the east or Wyoming in the west are putting all their money into the current sentiment to save the coal industry rather than to begin to look for alternative jobs, whether they're in clean energy, high tech, or anything else. The political money is still on saving coal and coal mining. Coal miners are very noble people. This is not something that should be taken personally, but it is a dying industry. Mm-hmm. They need to be looking for replacements, whether it's in energy or not.
Could I jump in, Michael, and say, the coal industry is really on the downturn and the solar industry is on the upturn. And I think there is some reason for optimism on some of these issues. We've seen the rapid decarbonization of our power sector. We're seeing major utilities saying they're going to be net zero carbon by 2050. And it's because, there is a market demand, there's a social demand for this, but we are seeing some trends. And I'll say we even are seeing some Republicans who are in office, beginning to realize that particularly for the younger voters, they need to be part of the solution on climate change. If you look at governors, you have to look to Maryland and Massachusetts for real leadership from Republicans on climate. But if you look in the House, right before coronavirus, you're looking at the minority leader McCarthy and his leadership coming up with climate change proactive actions from the Republican Party. They were met with a healthy dose of skepticism from the environmental community for some good reason, but it was showing that there was something moving for the young voters.
Meanwhile, though, you have a president who has put the former coal lobbyist in charge of the EPA, who has been working to weaken environmental regulations. What is that about? Is that about playing to the coal industry as a candidate and the president following through on that promise, I'm going to save coal? Is it about money? Is it about something else? What's that about? Tim.
Yeah. All right, I'll jump. It's about politics, and it's about base politics. And if anything we know about President Trump, his politics are grounded in appealing to his passionate base. And his passionate base truly is against action on climate change. He is Murray Cole has been a major supporter. He's one of those companies out in the Powder River and in the East Coast that is looking to survive. And he is appealing to his political base.
But why? Why does the political base have that impression? Peter, the Pew Research Center released a poll that shows that the share of Americans who say that global climate change is a major threat to the well-being of the country has grown from 44% in 2009 to 60% this year, mainly from Democrats, not many Republicans. They remain largely unchanged. But why? They all live on the planet with us. Democrats and Republicans, is it just that they're not being told or they don't believe what they're being told? Peter.
Well, you can look back to the last time that those poll numbers jumped would be around 2005, 2006. And the events that happened that were directly in the faces of Americans were Hurricane Katrina and a year in which the hurricanes in the Atlantic made it all the way through the alphabet, and they had to use the Greek alphabet to count all the hurricanes that either made landfall or that washed out in the ocean. It was on the news every night. In the successive year, the IPCC and Al Gore won the Nobel Peace Prize, and Al Gore also won a Grammy. I believe a documentary Oscar for his slideshow. All of that happened because Americans became more aware. Within a year or two, the economy fell apart and interest once again dropped. I'm really curious to see what happens when with the economy dropping this year and whether that repeats itself.
Peter Dykstra is an environmental journalist with Environmental Health News. You also hear him on Public Radio International's Living on Earth. And Tim Profeta is director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions at Duke University. We will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. If you're looking for more conversations around local and national politics, then look no further than Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte. WFAE's new podcast covering the RNC and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/insidepolitics. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the environment and the politics of the environment and how they have shifted from the very first Earth Day 50 years ago this coming Wednesday to today. With Tim Profeta, director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions at Duke University, and Peter Dykstra, an environmental journalist with the Environmental Health News at EHN.org and also Public Radio International's Living on Earth. President Trump has made eliminating federal regulations a priority. He has targeted environmental rules that he sees as burdensome to the fossil fuel industry and big business. He's rolled back 58 regulations completely. 37 more are underway. That's 95 projects that are all involving air pollution and emissions and drilling and extractions, infrastructure, animals, toxic chemicals and substances, and water pollution. Has business been complaining about the onerous nature of these regulations, or is this just another example of doing something that appeals to the base and people who are skeptical of science and who think that snail darter saving is just a stupid waste of time, effort, and money, Peter?
Well, one example of where the president has gone farther than what some in the auto industry wanted It's fuel economy. There are several big automakers who were grudgingly accepting of President Obama's much higher standards for fuel economy in cars and trucks. President Trump went farther than those automakers even wanted. So he's not granting the wishes of industry. And let me back up and say one other thing. We talked about a coal lobbyist running EPA, Andrew Wheeler. But in fairness to President Trump, he did not pick a coal lobbyist to run the Interior Department. David Bernhardt is a former oil lobbyist. And I just want to make sure we're clear about that.
Okay, thank you very much. If the president got his way and is able to roll back Obama-era regulations and other things that have been on the books for long before President Obama was in the White House, what would the environmental impact be, Tim? Where would we, would we go back to pre-1970 levels of rivers catching on fire and being able to not see the top of buildings in Los Angeles because the air is brown and thick?
You could define a future where we rolled fully back the clean air, the clean water protections and the like, but that, in all candor, is not what's happening right now. In fact, you know, most of the core protections of those acts are still in place, and even the rollbacks are being attempted by President Trump right now may not be legal. You know, they'll be litigated, and really, I think the most important date for the future of that regulatory, those regulations, is November 2020, because I think you know, if President Trump gets another 4 years, he'll be able to kind of go back and fix some problems with the legality of the rollbacks and really secure that. But if he doesn't have a gain re-election, I think, particularly with the support of a majority of American people, I guess now with President Biden, would be able to put a lot of those protections in place. But the first point is, I don't think we're talking about getting rid of the permitting program for water pollution or the basic Clean Air Act provisions. We're talking about the provisions that President Obama tried to put in place to directly address things like climate and these next generation environmental problems that are hitting us.
Prior to the outbreak of coronavirus, a survey published by The Atlantic showed that climate was the number two issue, second only to health care, for Democrats in primary or caucus states. Climate sat among four other mainstay concerns: health care, the economy, jobs, immigration, Social Security. They're kind of lumped together. Those concerns may have shifted because of COVID-19, but climate is still up there, I would think. In the minds of most Americans, is climate tied to our impact on the environment through the burning of fossil fuels, or is something else at work here in their minds, Tim?
Well, I think the majority of Americans believe that climate change is happening and is caused by human beings. And once you get there, then you have to start looking at the solutions to the problem. And you point out a very good point. In the Democratic primaries all through 2019, climate was a major motivating force for the Democratic voters, particularly young voters. It was usually number two, in some polls, number two, only behind somebody who can beat Donald Trump as something people valued in their vote. It is also penetrating the young Republican demographic, as I spoke about earlier, and because young voters see that this is the planet they're inheriting and it needs to be cared for. Now, all that is pre-COVID and pre-coronavirus, and so we're not quite sure how durable that will be, as Peter was talking about. But the one thing I'd say is for the young voters and those young voters that Vice President Biden will need to motivate, I think climate is still an incredibly important issue, and you will see it emerge as a number two or a number three in his campaign. Not everything is coronavirus and everything is a far, you know, behind number two issue, but it's an issue that he tries to work on to ensure that he's hearing the voice of the young voters.
And you say that the politics of climate change is beginning to shift in America. How so?
I think it's really shifting because we're going from a politics of speculation, of forecasting that we are going to be having effects from climate change, to a politics of reality. People are actually seeing the impacts now and suffering from them. You know, Peter talked about Katrina in our home state of North Carolina. We have two rounds of hurricane relief funding still coming to the coastal plain from recent storms. People are seeing the saltwater intrusion in Miami. People are seeing the, you know, the events that were forecast to happen from climate change. Now they're real. Now, you know, we can get in a fight about if any particular hurricane was caused by climate change, but what we know is they're going to come more frequently, the storms, the intense weather events. And as people are realizing that the impacts are there, they're beginning to realize that this is something we need to act on. And this also penetrates very importantly into rural America. The farmers, the ranchers know the land is different, know the weather is different. And they realize that we need to act. And if we're going to make this a bipartisan issue again, we need to reach the people who aren't in the urban areas.
And Peter,
well,
you say,
I agree that there's a change in the wind. It's a question of whether it will be enough and whether it will be soon enough.
Well, you say, Peter, that unfortunately people respond to past disasters, not future ones. But these past disasters, like the incredible fires in California and in Australia, and the fact that farmers know that the land is changing, and we have 100-year floods every year now, those are recent past disasters. Is that not going to have an impact?
It is, but like I said, we're still waiting to see if that change will be sufficient. If you asked me 10 years ago, if nations like Australia and Brazil and the United States would have presidents that are openly expressing serious doubts about climate science in this day and age, I would have told you that that's impossible. But it's our reality. It gives us more to overcome in terms of putting the world on the right path to lower carbon emissions, to bring up safe and clean energy and make the world safer rather than kissing the Outer Banks goodbye.
So we have a couple of email questions that have come in while we've been talking. One asks, what happens if a Democrat becomes president? Is it just like flipping a switch and going back to pre-Trump policies? Tim.
That's a great question. I would think at this point, the presumptive nominee is Biden. If Vice President Biden becomes president, I would think there would be an immediate activation of the executive branch and it's all of its pre-existing authorities to address climate change. I do think we would see that. It would be probably, again, behind or at least wrapped in with our attempts for economic stimulus that we forecast will be necessary because of COVID. The bigger issue is whether it becomes a flip of a switch where half of America is supportive and half of America is now complaining in other talk show formats about these activities, or whether the president can build something that can get you a larger majority of Americans behind it so that if 4 years later, a Republican comes in, we don't just flip back. And because the one thing industry and businesses do not like, we're trying to plan for this transition and eventually we'll have to do to deal with climate change, is all the back and forth and the whiplash of policy. They need to have a long horizon that they can plan for.
We know, Peter, where President Trump stands on environmental regulation and the environment and on climate change. We know where some of the former Democratic presidential candidates stood on those issues. Where does Joe Biden stand, and how do Democrats and independents view the fact that he really hasn't talked about this issue very much?
Well, when Al Gore ran for president, he kind of stopped talking about climate as well, because even then it was viewed as a polarizing issue. One thing about Joe Biden, he loves his home state. He loves Delaware. It is the lowest lying state in the union. It's going to have major problems from sea level rise. And as Tim said, some of the signs of sea level rise impact are happening already. Two of the biggest factors that will determine how much happens on the policy front. Number one is who controls the Senate. Mitch McConnell brags about how effectively he blocked so many of President Obama's initiatives. The other one is who controls the courts. And President Trump is very proud of the literally hundreds of appointments that he's made to district court judgeships, to the appeals courts, and to the Supreme Court. Those are lifetime appointments, and it's going to change the face of litigation for a long time. Litigation has been a major environmental weapon. It may be blunted to some degree because of that.
The Atlantic also writes in that article that I referred to a few minutes ago that climate change has become more polarized now than any other issue, including abortion. I mean, how can that be? Abortion is all wrapped up in religion, so it's easy to understand the objections to abortion for those who do object to it. But we all live on the same planet. How can this be worse than abortion in terms of the controversy surrounding it? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question. Who wants to take that?
I'll grab it.
Okay.
Climate denial is durable, and it's something that very sophisticated and clever, let's call it a propaganda operation, can build on. Another one of my favorite examples is we're coming up in June on the 35th anniversary of the infamous Newsweek article that briefly talked about global cooling. There are a lot of climate deniers that talk about that science from 35 years ago.
Well, what about that? What about that science? I mean, that proved is it proven wrong? Why was it wrong?
It was certainly an honestly offered valid potential scenario, but it went away in a hurry as climate science became more sophisticated and more abundant. There's also the argument that climate scientists are in it for the money. That's garbage. And a lot of, if you go into the nonprofit 990 forms, you can see that the people who say that climate scientists are after the money generally make more than climate scientists do. One final thing about that global cooling story. 35 years ago, I was attending my senior prom, and the number one performers on the hit parade were the Captain and Tennille, and we're now in a Beyonce world. It's very, very different.
Here's a question you can't answer. Why am I always the oldest person on the program? That's what I... We have another email comment. I'd say people do believe scientists. It's just that we've allowed people on the margins of this issue to define it for their political gain. You agree with that, Tim?
Yes, actually, if you look at the campaign on the science that was sort of kicked off in the mid-90s by several of the fossil fuel industries, they realized they lost the science battle, they'd lose the political battle on climate change. So they created a cadre of scientists who would cross reference each other to create sort of a shadow scientific record of climate denialism. And it was by doing that that they were able to offer your listeners political party, offer them a science they could rely on and experts they could rely on to feel comfortable with denying on climate change. I really think, though, two things I want to make sure before we lose. I think things have started to shift. I think because we're no longer just talking about models, we're talking about real impacts. And I think we really have to not polarize this issue, those of us who want action. We have to try and embrace a way that we can work across the aisle and with other people, because the more that we talk about how the Republicans don't support this and only the Democrats do, the more we're really locking in that polarization. And I think there's an ability to find a way forward. And if there isn't, then we're in big trouble because our system of government requires two-party governance.
So we have about 30 seconds left. How would you describe, Peter, the state of the environmental movement in the United States today? Is it over? Is it beating its head against the wall? Is it lying dormant, waiting for the political winds to shift? What's going on? Quickly.
It's changed. It's still a solid movement. It's clearly too white, which has been a criticism for decades. But it has the power to begin to change the American will. We'll see how that all works post-coronavirus.
Peter Dykstra writes for Environmental Health News, EHN.org, and is heard on Public Radio International's Living on Earth. And Tim Profeta is director of the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy Solutions at Duke University. Thank you both for the hour. Stay safe. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.